On Medium, we believe that words matter. That's why we're building the best place for words on the internet, all without a single ad in sight. For just $5 a month, members get unlimited access to the best stories on Medium, stories like the one you'll hear on today's episode. So sign up today at medium.com/membership. Now, enjoy the show. Take it away, Kara.
Welcome to the very first episode of Medium Playback. On each episode, we'll invite a writer we absolutely love into the studio to read a story they wrote for Medium. Afterwards, they'll stick around and we'll chat with the author to get you the story behind the story. I'm Kara Brown. I'm a writer who covers pop culture and race, and I watch way too much television. I'll be alternating hosting duties with writer and podcaster extraordinaire Manoush Zomorodi, who covers the intersection of technology and humanity. We'll be releasing new episodes every other week, so be sure to follow Playback on Medium or subscribe on your podcast app of choice. So let's get started. I'm so excited to be joined today by Roxane Gay, best-selling writer and feminist and destroyer of Twitter trolls all over the internet. She'll read her essay from Medium, What Fullness Is, and then stick around and chat with us about it. Hi, Roxane. Welcome to Playback.
Hi, Kara. Thanks for having me.
In your incredibly moving piece, you write about all that led up to your decision to undergo weight loss surgery in January. Why did you decide to write about it?
I was thinking about the essay I wanted to contribute to this Unruly Bodies project that I'm curating at Medium, and I just thought, oh, the story is going to come out sooner or later, and so I would rather be the one who puts the story out into the universe. And I had been thinking since the surgery and, frankly, before the surgery about the cultural mandates to discipline the fat body and how barbaric this surgery actually is. And so I decided to kind of put all of my feelings and thoughts about it into hopefully a good essay.
It is very good. So let's dive in. Here's Roxane Gay reading her piece, What Fullness Is.
What Fullness Is. The first weight loss surgery was performed during the 10th century on D. Sancho, the king of León, Spain. He was so fat that he lost his throne, so he was taken to Cordoba, where a doctor sewed his lips shut. Only able to drink through a straw, the former king lost enough weight after a time to return home and reclaim his kingdom. The notion that thinness, and the attempt to force the fat body toward a state of culturally mandated discipline, begets great rewards, is centuries old. Modern weight loss surgery began in the 1950s when surgeons employing various techniques caused their patients fairly distressing problems like severe diarrhea, dehydration, kidney stones, gallstones, and even death. But, generally, the patients lost weight. Surgeons have since refined their techniques using a range of restriction or malabsorption methods to force the human body to lose weight. They have tried wiring patients' jaws shut to force weight loss through liquid diets. They have stapled stomachs into smaller pouches to restrict calorie intake. They have developed gastric bands and balloons to restrict the amount of food that can enter the stomach. But it was the first laparoscopic gastric bypass, in which the gastrointestinal tract is routed around a person's stomach, performed in 1994, that enabled bariatric surgery to go more mainstream by way of minimal invasion. Some of these interventions have succeeded for people and some have failed, because not even surgical intervention can overcome the reasons why many people gain and then struggle to lose weight. Some bodies and minds simply cannot be brought to heal. I capitulated to a procedure after more than 15 years of resistance and had a sleeve gastrectomy at the UCLA Ronald Reagan Hospital in January 2018. I told only a few people. I did not tell my family. I felt, in equal parts, hope, defeat, frustration, and disgust. The first time I contemplated weight loss surgery, it was at the bidding of my parents. My father and I went to an orientation seminar at the Cleveland Clinic and learned about gastric bypass. There were graphic, deeply disturbing videos, a question and answer session. I submitted myself to a clinical assessment about the problem of my body. It wasn't the right time, I decided. I could be better, eat less, move more. And over the next several years, I certainly tried to, intermittently or constantly, depending on how you look at it. I continued a near lifetime of disordered eating and restriction and overeating. Sometimes I was motivated enough to work out, sometimes I wasn't. Mostly I was overwhelmed by inertia. I had a desire to lose weight, but an inability, or perhaps an unwillingness, to force myself toward the deprivation required for the significant weight loss the world told me I needed. The truth is that my desire for weight loss has long been about satisfying other people more than myself, finding a way to fit more peacefully into a world that is not at all interested in accommodating a body like mine. And the dominant cultural attitude toward fatness is that the fat body is a medical problem, a drain on society, an aesthetic blight. As a fat person, I'm supposed to want to lose weight. I am supposed to be working on the problem of my body. I am supposed to apply discipline to physical unruliness. I am not supposed to be fine with my body. I am not supposed to yearn, simply, for people to let me be, see me, accept me, and treat me with dignity exactly as I am. I am sometimes fine with my body, though. I am fine with my curves, the solidity of me. I am strong and tall. I enjoy the way I take up space, that I have presence. I have someone who appreciates my body and only hates everything I must deal with by virtue of living in this world, in this body. Sometimes I hate my body, the unruliness of it. I hate all my limitations. I hate my lack of discipline. I hate how my unhappiness is never enough to truly motivate me to regain control of myself once and for all. I hate the way I hunger but never find satisfaction. I want and want and want, but never allow myself to reach for what I truly desire, leaving that want raging desperately beneath the surface of my skin. And the moment I step outside the safety of my home, I hate how visible I am, how people treat me, how they stare and comment both loudly and under their breath, how rude children remind me I'm fat and their rude parents say nothing, how I have to think and overthink where I go and how I will fit in any given space. I do not know how to carry myself with confidence when I go out into the world. Any sense of self I have is often shattered within minutes, and then I am all insecurities and fears, wishing myself into a more socially acceptable form. And given my career trajectory, there are pictures and videos of me everywhere. I hate these images, cringe when I see them, and then I hate myself for cringing, for not seeing myself with kindness. Trolls make memes of my pictures and post them to internet message boards with cruel captions. They tweet these memes at me. They remind me every chance they get that I am fat, more than, but less than. Every single day, I am confronted by how people really see me. I am confronted by the fact that no matter what I achieve, I will always be fat first. I will always have this weakness. It will always be easily exploited. If you're not one statistic, though, you're another. According to the American Society for Bariatric and Metabolic Surgery, 216,000 people received a bariatric procedure in 2016. Weight loss surgery is touted by doctors as the gold standard for weight loss, though a relatively small number of the estimated one-third of Americans who are considered obese actually get the surgery. Many doctors have used that exact phrase with me, the gold standard. They told me that this surgery will save my life and that if I didn't get the surgery, I wouldn't live until 40. When I turned 40, they told me that if I didn't get the surgery, I wouldn't live until 50. This surgery is touted as the only real option for the morbidly and supermorbidly obese. It is not a question of if a fat person will get weight loss surgery, but when. Of course, weight loss surgery is extraordinarily expensive, and many insurance policies will not cover it. The out-of-pocket cost is high enough that many people travel to Mexico and Malaysia to get it for a fraction of the cost in the United States. My insurance company will cover weight loss surgery, but only after you've gone through 6 months of medically supervised weight loss. You have to prove that you deserve to have yourself cut open. Given my schedule, this 6-month waiting period was a requirement I was never going to be able to meet, so I ended up paying for the surgery out of pocket. I suppose I should be grateful that I could afford to do so, but mostly I'm bitter. The expense was breathtaking. If there is a silver lining, the expense also removed a lot of bureaucratic red tape. I was able to schedule my surgery and address all the pre-surgical requirements with relative ease once the surgeon realized he didn't have to deal with an insurance company. Healthcare is as wantonly susceptible to the ills of capitalism as everything else. After more than 15 years of refusing it, I made the decision to get weight loss surgery on an ordinary day. At home in Lafayette, Indiana, a young man yelled at me to move my fat black ass while I was crossing a grocery store parking lot to my car. It was the last straw. I tried to hold my head high, shuffled as quickly as I could, put my groceries in my car, and sat behind the steering wheel. I sat there shaking, wishing I could have been as quick in that moment to put him in his place as I would have been online. I wanted to call someone for comfort, but I was at a silent impasse with the only person to whom I could talk. Instead, I pressed my head against the steering wheel and I sobbed. When I collected myself, I drove home and went to bed. I hoped I might not wake up, but I did. The most common weight loss procedures today are the gastric bypass and the gastric sleeve. These procedures are usually done laparoscopically in a matter of hours, with the patient under general anesthesia. In the gastric bypass, the stomach is reduced, creating a small pouch that is then connected farther down the small intestine. The sleeve gastrectomy is a slightly less drastic procedure and the more common one performed. The stomach size is reduced and reshaped into a slender tube, restricting how much a person can eat. In these procedures, patients also lose their appetite as a result of reduced ghrelin, a hormone that stimulates appetite. In both procedures, patients' anatomy is irreversibly changed and they lose a significant amount of weight quickly. Both procedures result in malnutrition, requiring patients to take multivitamins and other supplements for the rest of their lives. Other risks and complications include hair loss, ulcers, leaks, gastric bleeding, bowel obstruction, gallstones, and dehydration. These are all fairly horrifying risks, but, the medical establishment has decided, they are less horrifying than the medical risks of fatness. People who choose weight loss surgery trade one kind of health for another. After such drastic weight loss, many patients need expensive, extensive plastic surgery to deal with the excess skin. TLC even has a show, spun off from My 600-Pound Life, called Skin Tight, about people who have lost a significant amount of weight and want to get skin removal surgery, altering their anatomy once again. And with the growing popularity of bariatric surgery, an entire industry has risen around it. Supplements, special foods, dishware, and more. There are online forums, YouTube channels, bariatric eating blogs, and other such communities. Where there is money to be made, capitalism finds a way. The morning after I decided to get weight loss surgery, I called a local bariatric surgeon and made an appointment for a consultation. A few hours later, the program administrator called me back and told me I would need to lose 75 pounds before they would even consider operating. I immediately felt hopeless. If I could lose 75 pounds on my own, I wouldn't be considering surgery. The surgeon, the coordinator told me, was involved in some kind of study and only wanted good outcomes. He did not inspire me with confidence. I was told to go watch some online videos about the surgery, fill out a lot of paperwork, and then we could get started. After a few days of allowing myself to wallow in defeat, I got a recommendation from a friend and found an excellent surgeon in Los Angeles, where I also live, who did inspire me with confidence. This surgeon was very frank. I just stared and nodded. He told me at our first appointment in December that surgery was my best option. He remarked that it was good that I carried most of my weight in my lower body because it would be easier for him to do the surgery. I was an unruly body for him to fix. Nothing less, nothing more. He asked me to try to lose some weight before surgery to reduce the size of my liver, but wasn't too prickly or unrealistic about it. Just don't gain any more weight, he said. I looked at my work calendar for 2018 and realized I had a small window within which to do this surgery and recover. Before I lost my nerve, I rescheduled the two events I had in January and told my doctor I wasn't going to be able to wait 6 weeks before flying again post-surgery, as recommended. In a matter of hours, I was scheduled for surgery in early January. I was then weighed and measured. I had blood drawn and an EKG and an echocardiogram performed. I attended a 3-hour workshop where I learned more about the surgery, how to prepare, what the initial weeks and after the surgery would be like, and so on. A nutritionist cautioned us not to visit online forums about bariatric surgery, and I heeded her advice until I didn't. I received a binder full of information, much of it rather starkly depressing, about the lifestyle changes that would be demanded of me both before and after the surgery. I bought vitamins and whey protein and tried to wrap my mind around the vastly different way I'd have to be eating in just a few weeks. I saw a psychologist who would determine if I was emotionally prepared for the surgery. After 45 minutes, she determined that I was and charged me $300. During every part of the preoperative process, I doled out obscene sums of money to a range of medical providers, and every night I stared at the ceiling wondering if I would actually go through with it. I chastised myself for allowing myself to get to this point, for lacking the discipline to lose weight by any other means. I had made a drastic decision to change my body, but I did not suddenly develop a healthier relationship toward food. In the weeks leading up to my surgery, I tried to eat all the foods I thought I was probably never going to be able to eat again, paying particular and loving attention to fried foods and soda. A few nights before surgery, friends and I went to my favorite steakhouse, and I enjoyed a Caesar salad and a finely marbled ribeye with mashed potatoes and green beans almondine, and butter cake with fresh whipped cream, and gin and tonics with a splash of grenadine. I savored every single bite, often with my eyes closed. I mourned what I was losing, or what I thought I was losing. The morning of the surgery, I went to the hospital, checked in, was weighed, and escorted to a long row of hospital beds, just waiting for patients who would submit themselves to surgical blades for one reason or another. I was hungry and thirsty and nervous. I told the friend accompanying me that the gown the hospital provided probably wouldn't fit, and she said that couldn't possibly happen, given the nature of my impending procedure. I was right. The gown was indeed too small, and at 6 a.m, I was too tired and too defeated to even laugh or feel any kind of satisfaction for understanding just how short-sighted this world is when it comes to different kinds of bodies. As I do any time I'm going under general anesthesia, I told the anesthesiologist to give me extra because I've seen the movie Awake. I was racked with guilt about not telling my family and then worried that I was probably going to die and my parents would find out in such a terrible way. As I worried, I was strapped to the operating table and then, mercifully, I lost consciousness. I don't remember anything about the surgery, and I'm thankful for that because it means the drugs worked. When I woke up, a nurse was peering at me, and then she broke into a smile. She said, "I know who you are. My girlfriend and I love your books." I was still pretty out of it, so I muttered, "Please don't tell the internet I'm here." I care too much what people think. I hate that about myself. Before and after my surgery, I worried what people would think if and when they found out. Each time I went to the doctor's office, I prayed no one would recognize me, and rarely were those prayers answered. I'm just a writer, but I am recognized in public with alarming frequency. "What are you doing here?" a fan asked one afternoon as I walked into the UCLA Medical Center, and I smiled and said, "Routine checkup." I worried that people would think I betrayed fat positivity, something I do very much believe in, even if I can't always believe in it for myself. I worried that everyone who responded so generously to my memoir, Hunger, would feel betrayed. I worried I would be seen as betraying myself. I worried I would be seen as taking the easy way out, even though nothing about any of this has been easy, not one thing. I worried. The surgeon made 5 neat incisions across my torso and stitched them from the inside so I would eventually have minimal scarring. As I came to my senses, I felt each of those incisions throbbing gently, reminding me something invasive had happened to my body. The worst part of the first few hours after the surgery was that I couldn't drink anything until the following morning. I had a brand new stomach and a whole lot of stitches holding that brand new stomach together, so it was best to leave this newly delicate anatomy alone. As the hours wore on, I felt desiccated. I wanted water more than I have ever wanted anything in my life. I could only satisfy myself with a tiny sponge dipped in ice to dab on my lips and tongue. When no one was looking, I took tiny sips of the melted water pooling at the bottom of my styrofoam cup. I did. The hospital buzzed around me. Nurses doted on me. My surgeon stopped by and told me everything had gone well. My liver was nice and small, he said with a smile, and commended me for losing weight before the procedure. I felt a swell of pride and then hated myself for that swell, for being so pedestrian as to take pleasure in the sort of validation that goes against much of what I believe about how bodies should be allowed to be. There was a TV, but I couldn't bother to focus on it. I was on excellent pain medication I controlled with a little remote, so it was all very pleasant, less the torment of the desert of my mouth. The woman next door also had weight loss surgery, and she talked loudly about how she was a changed woman. It was like she was trying to prove she deserved the surgery, that she was a better woman now. It was aggravating because I did not feel at all changed. I did not have a new outlook on life. Every few hours, I got up and walked around so as to avoid blood clots. I dozed. I chatted drowsily with loved ones watching over me. Eventually, I passed out, all praise to Dilaudid. Late the next afternoon, I went home where I could only have water, clear broth, Gatorade, and sugar-free Jell-O for 3 days. From weeks 2 to 4, I could only eat soft foods. My new diet was as horrible and boring and bland as you might imagine, but it was also manageable. Anything is manageable if it isn't forever. Slowly, I started coming to terms with how quickly my relationship to food was changing and how disordered my relationship to food had been and for so long. I had to think carefully about what I ate and how. I became full after only a few bites. I had to think about protein and making sure I was getting enough. I never did because I'm a very picky eater, and the protein shakes made me gag. I wasn't hungry, but I was starving. That incident in the parking lot was also an accumulation of frustrations and heartache I no longer wanted to carry. Doctors not taking me seriously and always trying to treat my weight before anything else, never fitting in spaces I wanted to be in, the obsessive rituals I developed around deciding if and how I could go out in public, feeling unfit and hating exercise because everything was so arduous, having such limited fashion options, the familial concern that was a yoke I couldn't ever get out from under, the societal concern that was a yoke I couldn't ever get out from under, the nagging worry that my weight would eventually come between me and the one person in my life who has never made me feel anything but good in my body. The nagging worry that eventually my luck would run out and all the terrible things doctors had long been warning me about would come to pass. I had to face the extent of my unhappiness and how much of that unhappiness was connected to my body. I had to accept that I could change my fat body faster than this culture will change how it views, treats, and accommodates fat bodies. And I had to do so while recognizing that losing weight wasn't actually going to make me happier, which may have been the bitterest part of all. That's how I found myself going back to therapy after nearly a decade away, a decade of telling myself I was fine and fixed and emotionally whole. The nutritionist affiliated with my surgeon gave me a recommendation, and I made an appointment. Within the first 5 minutes, I knew it wasn't going to work. She stared at me for long, intensely awkward lengths of time. At the beginning of the session, she was simply silent, and I was not at all sure what I was supposed to do with that silence. After 2 sessions, I decided to try someone else. He was a brash, handsome older man who got under my skin, forcing me to face uncomfortable truths, forcing me to get comfortable with feeling my feelings, something I've avoided for most of my life. At some point during many of our sessions, he says, "You're mad at me," and I pretend I'm not, and he knows I'm lying, and onward we go, doing the necessary work of breaking me down so someday I might build myself up again. The dominant narrative around weight loss surgery is that it changes your life and makes everything better. That's a lovely fantasy, that by cutting yourself open and having parts of yourself removed, everything that weighed you down will be lifted. But it is only a fantasy. People who have weight loss surgery are more likely to commit suicide. Many married people get divorced after the surgery because their spouses cannot cope with the changes, so much so that bariatric divorce is a thing. The psychologist I saw for my pre-surgical evaluation warned me that the first year is really difficult and many patients end up suffering from depression and regretting the surgery. The second year is better, she said, trying to reassure me after my face fell. And she was right. I am depressed and miserable. I'm cold all the time and exhausted because I'm only eating between 1,200 and 1,500 calories a day. I am filled with regrets because everything has changed, but everything is exactly the same. I am losing a significant amount of weight very quickly. That's what the scale shows on those rare occasions when I'm not too afraid to get on the scale, terrified I've done all this, spent all this money, only to not lose weight. My clothes are looser. My shoes are inexplicably loose. My ring is loose. I fit in my car in a way I never have. I fit in chairs better. I fit everywhere better. And it is still so early. But I cannot believe that I'm losing weight despite all this evidence. I've told my person more than once that someone is messing with me, sabotaging my sanity by adjusting the seat in the car, stretching my clothes and shoes out to trick me. I am assured such is not the case, that my body is actually changing. For a few moments, I am quieted, and then the doubt creeps back in. When I look in the mirror, I see no difference, none at all. No one, save for a couple people, has openly acknowledged any weight loss, if they've even noticed, which is a relief and a frustration and a reminder of just how much weight I have to lose. I don't want any weight loss to be acknowledged, or worse, celebrated, but I also very much do. I've replaced one set of anxieties with another. I worry I'm eating too much and stretching my new stomach, something I was warned about repeatedly and vigorously. I have brief moments where I allow myself to imagine hiking Runyon Canyon or wearing a fabulous outfit because it is available in my size or going to see a musical without making special arrangements. And then I tell myself to get a hold of myself. I tell myself not to want. I tell myself I've failed to discipline my body before and I will probably fail this time too. I tell myself these things because I've carried this weight for almost 30 years, and it is terrifying to face who I could be without it. I had weight loss surgery, but I am still the same person I was when I went under the knife. I still have that yawning cavern inside of me that I want to fill with food, only now I cannot fill it with food. I'm rarely hungry, but I am ravenous. Want continues to rage desperately beneath the surface of my skin. I turned to food when I was sad and happy and lonely and scared and anxious. I turned to food and away from everything else. It was my comfort and my friend. Food helped me survive something I did not think I would survive. Food numbed the uncomfortable feelings I very much did not want to feel. And then the comfort was gone. I've lost the best friend I never had the courage to acknowledge, but who was my constant, loyal companion nonetheless. I am left holding the shattered pieces of whatever has been left behind, trying to assemble them into something new, something that serves me better. The forced restriction brought about by the surgery is maddening. Yes, I eat, but I physically cannot overeat. At restaurants, wait staff interrogate me about all the food I leave on my plate. At home, I eat sad, tiny portions, or, given what I used to eat, what feels like tiny portions. After a few bites of anything, the discomfort begins, and then that discomfort evolves into pain. Sometimes, when I'm feeling rebellious, I try to ignore that pain and try to surrender to my desire to eat with abandon. My body reminds me that rebellion will not be tolerated. For the first time in as long as I can remember, I am empty, but I know what fullness is, and I hate this knowing.
Once again, that was Roxane Gay reading What Fullness Is, which was published as part of Unruly Bodies, a 25-essay anthology edited and curated by Roxane for Medium. Roxane, thank you so much for talking to us about your story, What Fullness Is, and for sharing such an incredibly personal story with us. In the story, you cycled through so many emotions in making the decision to have the surgery. Did writing about that decision and the outcome help you process it all?
Not really. I think it certainly put me on the path toward processing it all, but I think it's still too soon to really know. I just had a lot of thoughts and feelings from before and since the surgery. And I wanted to mark this moment in time because it's a very unique moment for me in my life. And I wanted to remember it in this way.
You also write that surgical intervention doesn't always mend why people struggle to gain weight and then to lose weight. Was that something that was on your mind while you were preparing for your surgery?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's always the fantasy and the hope that surgery will fix everything and you'll wake up and you'll be a completely new person and all of your problems will go away. But it doesn't do that at all. It introduces a whole suite of new problems. And so, you know, it was hard to find ways to reconcile reality with the fantasy.
Well, you just used the word hope, and you also used the word hope in the story when you were talking about some of the things you felt, hope, defeat, frustration, disgust. Was that the one emotion that sort of was pushing you through during the process?
Probably, definitely. Just the hope of just something different, no matter what that different thing is. And just trying something I hadn't tried before, however drastic it may have been. And so hope was definitely a great motivator.
Have you told your family about the surgery?
I told them a couple days ago.
Oh, wow.
I did.
How did they react?
My mom suspected because they had come to visit me about 3 weeks after the 3 or 4 weeks after the surgery, and I wasn't really eating much, and they were like really curious as to why, and I was really tired, and I just was like, oh, I'm fine, you know, I've just been working a lot, which is also true. And so they suspected, and then my brother saw me recently and he was like, Roxanne, what did you do? And I was like, nothing. And he's a tattletale and fucking snitch. So when I told them, they weren't super surprised. But, you know, my mom was like, why didn't you tell us? And we would have been there. And I was like, that's why I didn't tell you, because you would have driven the hospital crazy. And I know you, and I can't allow you to do that to those nurses. They don't deserve that.
You've written that in the past, your desire to lose weight was more about satisfying other people and other people's sort of ideas of you, more than it was about satisfying you yourself. Do you still feel that way?
Oh, definitely. I mean, peer pressure is real. it's mostly about myself, because at the end of the day, I'm the only one who lives in my body. But I definitely, you know, I go on TV now and it's just the comments I get are so horrifying after any television appearance. And it just, I hate that I limit myself and my career options because I am afraid of the blowback, and because the blowback hurts so much every time I go on TV. And so I just decided, you know, like, I'm going to change faster than people's attitudes toward fatness are going to change. And so I just took the plunge while also firmly believing that we need to change our cultural attitudes toward fatness. Like, this is not the solution. The solution is that people need to stop being horrible.
Right. So we're recording this a few hours after you published your essay on Medium, and you wrote that you were nervous your fans might think you were betraying fat positivity. Mm-hmm. How have you been feeling this morning? Have you gotten a sense of what the response to your piece has been?
I haven't seen the response yet, but once I made the decision to write this essay and publish it, I decided that whatever happens, happens. And nobody lives in my body but me. And so it's really between me and the people closest to me and no one else. And I hope that people are non-judgmental. I know some people will be, and I just can't control that or make decisions in my life because of what that judgment could be.
Well, with that said, has it gotten easier for you to do interviews about your body?
Oh, no, it never gets easier, because most interviewers are really terrible about it. And Hunger, the paperback, is about to come out, so I'm like just dreading it because it's going to be a shit show all over again. But I think that I have developed a thicker skin around some of the stupid questions that I am inevitably asked. And so that part does make it easier, in that I'm just like, I have no fucks left.
So there's a line in the story that's so powerful. I hate the way I hunger but never find satisfaction. It's something that everyone struggles with, and their own hunger and how it manifests itself in different ways. Do you find now after the surgery that hunger has subsided at all?
No, it hasn't. But I have recognized that it's an emotional hunger, not a physical hunger. And that's why I'm in therapy, trying to find healthier ways of satisfying that emotional hunger and making peace with it. But it's definitely still there.
One of the things I thought was really interesting was how you went out of pocket to pay for the procedure, in part because of all of the hoops you'd have to jump through in order for your insurance to cover the surgery. And it feels like one of the many different ways that society asks people to change or fix something about themselves, but then they make it very difficult or expensive to do so, sort of the way it's very expensive to be poor. Mm-hmm. What changes would you like to see in our healthcare system?
That's a great question. I would like to see all insurance companies cover weight loss surgery because doctors are consistently prescribing it as the solution. And you can't have it both ways where you say this is what you need to do to change your life, but we're not going to fund it. That's completely unfair. And so I had to pay out of pocket for logistical reasons. And fortunately, I could afford to, but I have spent about $30,000 on this surgery, and the surgery itself was $25,000. All the other specialists and the testing and everything else was a minimum of $5,000. And, you know, that's a lot of money. And it's a lot of money to me. I think it's a lot of money because I'm just a writer. It's a lot of money to everyone. I'm lucky enough that I had it, but nonetheless, I shouldn't have had to spend this money out of pocket to get this surgery so that maybe someday I can get my actual medical issues looked at with any sort of competence from medical doctors. It's incredibly frustrating, and I really hope that insurance companies will get better about this, but I don't believe they will.
Mm-hmm. Now that you've had some time to come up with the perfect response to the guy in the parking lot who yelled at you, what would you have told him?
I would have told him absolutely not. Go around me. Like, what the fuck? Like, I just... Yes. Or go back to your mother's basement, which is my favorite insult.
You were great with the Twitter trolls.
I mean, I wish I could just take my Twitter troll ethos and bring it to real life when people are assholes in real life. It rarely works that way. But, you know, if I have a screen in front of me, watch out.
One of the other things you write about in the story is how you keep trying to face the extent of your unhappiness and how that unhappiness is often connected to your body, and recognizing that even if you do lose weight, the unhappiness may still be there. Mm-hmm. So what are you doing now to try to chip away at that unhappiness?
I'm definitely back in therapy and working through my emotional landscape, for lack of a better word, and just trying to, I mean, I'm a natural depressive. I always have been. I actually went off Prozac so I could finish hunger because it's harder to write when I'm medicated. And so I'm just trying to find ways of being able to function and just dealing with my emotions and my history and my present and myself. And it's difficult, expensive work, but it's also useful work. And I'm glad that I am in a financial position to get therapy, and I wish everyone was, because it's really invaluable.
Yeah. When you wrote that when you looked in the mirror after the surgery, you didn't feel like you saw any real changes in your body, even though you knew that you were losing weight. How is your self-image now evolving?
I don't see any changes. It's incredibly frustrating. And I just have made peace with that. Like, it is what it is. And I just try to, like, get through each day and figure out, like, okay, what do I need to do to get through today? Everyone says the first year is just terrible, and they're not wrong. It's fucking terrible. And so I'm just, like, focusing on it's not always going to be this shitty.
And you do also talk about these moments of rebellion you have where you sort of try to rebel against your new body and, mm-hmm. and eat the way that you were eating before, and then you're reminded that that's not possible anymore.
Yeah.
Do you still find yourself going through those moments of rebellion?
Oh, absolutely. But, I mean, not as much anymore because, like, I mean, I've only tried it a couple times, to be honest, because it's so uncomfortable physically that it's just not even worth it. It's just like, this shit again. Like, fuck it. Like, you literally can't. It's just, I mean, I guess that's why the surgery works, especially early on. Like, it's just, there is such a hard wall that you hit after, like, half a cup of food. And it's so the wall is a very hard wall. There's no, like, breaking through it. There's no, like, forcing the food down. Like, if you do, you'll throw up. And so, you know, that's weird to, like, have that limitation where before, you know, there was no limit. It's just weird.
I know writers don't get to decide how people respond to their work and mm-hmm. how people react to their work, but if you could, is there something that you would hope more than anything that readers would take away from the story?
I think I just want people to take away that we all make decisions about our bodies and that those decisions should be respected. And that's really the only thing I want people to take away, that, you know, you don't know what someone else's lived experience is. And so trust them about their lived experience and trust them to make good decisions for themselves, even if you disagree with those decisions.
Roxanne, thank you so much for talking to us about your story, what fullness is, and for sharing so much of your personal story as well.
Thank you so much, Kara Brown.
Thank you.
I'm a fan.
Oh. And thank you so much for listening to Medium Playback. Look out for future episodes where we'll continue to share inspiring stories read by some of our favorite writers. You can find the new episodes in the audio section of the Medium app. If you're on iOS, tap the headphone icon at the top of the app. On Android, click audio from the menu bar. I'm your host, Kara Brown, and this episode of Medium Playback was produced by Rachel King and Leah Rose for Pod People, and by Sam Duboff and Alex McManus for Medium. If there's an author or story you'd like to hear in Playback, we'd love to hear from you. Send us a note on Twitter, we're at Medium, or by email, playback@medium.com. Until next time.